Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. Well, my guest today is Mr. Pat McDonald of HollywoodChicago.com, and thank you for being here today, Pat.
Thank you, always a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me again, Matt.
Totally.
One of the true pleasures in the city.
Well, Indie Outlook, you know, it's natural for Indie Outlook to be interested in the Indie Spirit Awards
because
they share, the same name. But this is one of the most interesting award shows for me because it offers kind of the alternate. It's an alternative to the Oscars. It's the stuff that probably will get shoved under the table as far as, you know, films that are worthy of being acknowledged but will not get that acknowledgement because they don't have massive millions of dollars funding their campaigns. I feel like, and even in this, I mean, I think that over the years, the Indie Spirit Awards have gotten a little more susceptible to those campaigns. But still, I feel like they do get enough names in there that are really worth acknowledging, worth highlighting. And that's why I want to talk about them a little bit, because the nominees were announced recently, and there's a lot of interesting names on there.
Well, the point that I will make, and we were talking briefly before we started this conversation, was about how the Independent Spirit Awards have been evolving. I won't even say changing, evolving. And I think one of the points that you just made is right on, that some of these films that we're going to talk about are literally in the mainstream and do have a marketing budget and do have the right stars to show up on that night. And I think when it first began, it was a little more under the radar, I should say. Mm-hmm. And now I think the industry is acknowledging that these films are the proving ground for the next, you know, $40 million man,
yes,
if you will.
Yes.
So.
And I think the whole question of what constitutes as indie, that's the same question I ask every time I pick a subject for a podcast or a subject for a blog, is like, what constitutes that? And I feel like that's the same question that they're asking here.
Yes.
Because that whole definition is just evolving, and you're going all the way back. You can go all the way back to Sundance, right, at the beginning of the year. What constitutes as indie there? And that directly affects what you see right at the end of the year with the Spirit Awards.
Well, also, too, you can see how they're evolving in the hosts. The hosts are becoming much more high profile. Whereas, you know, they had Rainn Wilson on 3 years ago. Again, he's known, but, you know, basically does a third role in the sitcom. And now they're going to have Andy Samberg this year. And then they had Joel McHale, was it last year or two? And he totally bombed. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just, I just see it becoming more and more all boats rising rather than we're the Independent Spirit Awards and you're the Oscars. You know?
Exactly, yeah.
So,
I mean, I remember one of my favorite special features on the Pulp Fiction two-disc DVD, it was one of my favorite DVDs growing up as a kid, was an extended conversation with Tarantino at the Indie Spirit Awards when Pulp Fiction won that year. And that was a big deal because that was the year of Forrest Gump, where everyone was like, well, Gump is going to be, you know, trumping all of the big names. And so I think they were I think it was actually Michael Moore interviewing Tarantino on this video.
He
was
interesting.
He was the guy talking, and they were just like, you know, this is the Justice Awards. This is where, you know, the real people get it. So there's a sense of, I don't want to say like elitism, but sort of
well,
like feeling
like, you
know.
Well, that's a perfect example of how long it's been around.
Exactly,
I mean, Pulp
Fiction,
you know, in the early 1991 it came out.
It was 94.
94,
that was 94.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
See you again, buddy.
No, that's all right.
Scattered memory. All right. So are we going to go just down the list on...
Well, that's kind of what I want to talk about just first before we delve in, is just what constitutes as indie this year? What are we sort of looking at as far as what constitutes as indie?
Right.
Because it's really been in the last decade or so, I'm just seeing more and more indie films with big names. It's like the producers really look for if you have that big name to at least get some sort of audience around it before it even gets released. And you're seeing a lot of that more and more in a lot of the acting nominees and things like that. Here,
I will also say I do believe that independent spirit type films, let's just put that category out there rather than try to define the term independent, those types of films are part of an up-and-coming actor's strategy now. Mm-hmm. If they can get one of those types of film and can be established as sort of a undergroundish type person as well as the above-the-line, you know, guy who drives the box office, they can be seen as more credible, I believe. But, you know, to define independent film now is a needle in a haystack. It has so many definitions. I mean, again, before this broadcast, we were talking about web and how influential that is becoming. So is a web movie an independent feature? Well, sure. Mm-hmm. And how far do you devolve or evolve from that, you know, spectrum?
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
I mean,
definitely.
That's exactly the way it goes.
Because there's so many different ways the whole concept of film is changing, and what constitutes as a film, what constitutes as release and everything like that.
Right,
so
I
think the Indie Spirit Awards, just from looking down the list on here, in some categories, especially like Best First Feature, things like that, they are highlighting, you know, smaller films, things like that. I think the Gotham Independent Spirit Independent Awards also had, I think, even more so a wider range as far as the films they were acknowledging. But I think the Indie Spirit Awards, I think they're seen less as that, you know, the Justice Awards, you know, the alternative. And there's a little more of a synonymous
connection. Getting closer to the Oscars every year.
Yeah.
That's another big change in the Independent Spirit
Awards. I think even Black Swan won.
Sure there's been a parallel. Yes. I mean, looking at this list here, I'm sure there's going to be one. Are we still doing the 10 Best Picture nominations? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's so malleable.
Now
I just feel like the Oscar people are just like, okay, who's going to raise the most money?
Yes,
you have to get
exactly.
it by this mark, and then we'll give you the nominations. Ooh. It's ridiculous.
Send me the most fabulous press junket.
Absolutely. Okay, so Best Feature, the thing I want to say right off the bat about Best Feature at the Indie Spirit nominations this year is that the two films that have the most nominees are ensemble films, and they are not neurotic, but they're like quirky comedies.
Yes.
It's kind of lighter fare this year for the most part.
Well, except maybe for Beasts of Southern Wild. And we see Girls nominated for Best Feature.
Oh, wait, which one?
Do we have the same list?
Wait, what a second. Wait. Girls? You mean the HBO series? what is this? What is this? No, I have no idea what that is. That's crazy. I've never seen that. That was not on my nominee list. So you're saying that Girls, the HBO series.
Listen, we may be completely off here, and now we're heading into the abyss, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh my gosh!
Well, no, what do you have for Best Feature?
Well, what I have for Best Feature is Beasts of the Southern Wild, Bernie, the Richard Linklater film.
Yes.
Keep the Lights On, the Ira Sachs lovely bittersweet movie. Moonrise Kingdom and Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah,
those are the ones I see.
On my list, Girls.
Where did you get that list?
I don't know.
Let me look at this list really quick. Where is this? This is on the LA Times. And so on the LA Times list, well, but this is newsworthy, at least just to say this, is they're saying that the HBO series Girls, Judd Apatow produced, is one of the Best Feature nominees. Hey, you know what? If I was doing the thing, I'd nominate it myself. So that's fine.
Well, that's what I said.
That's fine.
Matt's just going nuts. Girls.
No.
I don't know.
Well,
all right.
Well, the Lena Dunham Show Girls is one of my favorites.
So, yes.
Miniseries
yes,
of the year.
Talked
but
about that,
that is, wow. That's crazy.
So, yes, Silver Linings Playbook lighter, Moonrise Kingdom lighter, even though they have serious overtones. And Bernie, of course, very light, except, again, some dark overtones. Are we going to predict, or what do you say
favorites?
No.
Which ones do you think are the most worthy, I think,
as far as being nominated?
As true independent, or just as films that you thought were the best of the year? For me, I mean, Moonrise Kingdom is definitely up there. I think it's Anderson's, in my opinion, it's his best film. A lot of people will be like, hey, wait a second, what about Rushmore and things like that? I just feel like this is the best material for his style. I just feel like this is when every Wes Anderson film that I've seen, it just feels like it was leading up to this movie.
Well, I also felt it was a more mature Wes Anderson, a guy who had crossed a line in his perspective, whether it be experiential, familial, or just looking backwards.
Mm-hmm.
I found it to be one of the most brilliantly nostalgic films I've ever seen. Having grown up in that era, it was spot on, which is, you know, he absolutely was taking either his memories or the collective spirit of the memories that made that screenplay and completely produced a work that will live in the ages. I think that film will definitely have legs. The other two that were in my top 10 consideration were Bernie and Beasts of the Southern Wild. Bernie, a little more outside the sphere, but I found some elements in it that I enjoyed even more so the second time seeing it. And then Beasts of the Southern Wild, I had missed it in the theater or the initial release, caught up with it with DVD later, and I just found that film astounding. I think it's the Tree of Life of this year.
Well, I think that there's this sort of like counter opinion now with some critics, especially some younger critics that have an issue with it, which I think is interesting because this is a young director. It's a guy in his late 20s, and the main problem a lot of these critics are having, and I kind of understand where they're coming from, and I had some reservations myself.
All right, this is good.
Was just the dramatic subtext of the film, where it's like you're seeing so much of these people in the film. It's kind of like a New Orleans fantasy type thing.
Sure.
About these people who are kind of feel abandoned, you know, by the rest of the country, and yet they want to stay there because that's their home, and they're not going to leave their home, and no one's going to make them leave their home.
Well, highly symbolic as
highly
well.
Highly symbolic, absolutely.
I didn't see it as a time or place, really.
No, but it was just the whole concept of people choosing to stay in a certain place, even if it's going to lead to their death. I mean,
right.
I don't want to say too much about the plot, but it just felt kind of... It felt a bit forced. I felt like the uplift at the end, or the sense of uplift. It felt a bit too like it was exalting these people in a way that just felt a bit forced to me because it left me feeling very conflicted. At the end of the film, I don't feel kind of like rejuvenated or uplifted. I'm feeling very just divided down the center about like, okay, well, it's great that you're staying there. You know, and that's your home, and you have to respect as your home. But on another sense, it's a path to self-destruction in some ways.
Well, basically, that's why I compared it to Tree of Life, because I see it much more allegorical than you do, I believe. I see it as basically the life cycle being portrayed in a narrative form that skirts on fantasy and surreality and all levels of kind of consequence within the life cycle, or to put it a better way, the food chain.
Mm.
You know, I mean, the highly symbolic aspect of the beast and how they will eat their own to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an element of survival in that film that really moved me.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Well, no,
we can
I mean,
move
it's.
On, but...
Oh, sure. But I will say that is an absolute example of independent filmmaking at its most. And it's most impressive, purely, even just regardless of what you think of the story or the plot or the script, on a technical level of achievement, you really can't get more impressive than that. And I think this is absolutely the front runner in the best cinematography and best score category.
Absolutely.
This year, for
and
sure.
they were number one on both my life. Maybe I put Samsara above.
Okay, sure. Oh,
but,
yeah.
But, you know, what are you going to do?
Exactly. An entire film set to music. It's kind of, that's why the artist got the guy.
I want to talk a little about Keep the Lights On, because unfortunately I haven't been able to encounter it. And I just wanted to hear your feedback on it, because I'm a great admirer of Ira Sachs. And
yes.
I was hoping to talk to him this when he came over at the International, but unfortunately I had so many conflicts.
Yes.
And I couldn't catch up with him again. But, Tell me a little about that film.
This Thur Lindhart is the lead actor in the film, and it's a wonderful performance from him. And it's about this couple. You know, it's a gay couple, but mm-hmm. it has absolutely nothing to do with their orientation. Mm-hmm. That's what I love about so many films now that I'm seeing this year is it feels like we're entering kind of like a post gay realm, post orientation realm. It's just a relationship drama, and the great thing about Keep the Lights On is that it's about this. You know, sort of this deterioration of a relationship that anyone can relate to. When you're dealing with someone who is not well, who has addiction problems, and you feel like you're kind of the caregiver in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anyone could relate to that, and anyone of any gender, race, what have you, can relate to these themes. For me, there was something about that film that left me a little cold emotionally. I didn't feel like I got to know the other guy as well. I felt like we were with like we were with the main character for a while. But it was a lovely piece.
And you
sure.
saw that in his previous picture, Married Man.
Yeah.
Did you see Married Man?
Was that Married Life
with
Chris Cooper? Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You're never going to have me on the show.
No,
again. All
no,
right.
Please, no.
I always get the names and
the dates. Yeah, well, and
yes,
this...
I am a film critic.
But this film was a lot more emotionally compelling to me than Married Life.
Okay.
For me, I was a little...
Well, that was that was a broader film.
Exactly.
Married Life, it was...
It was more of a polished period piece. Right. Keep the Lights On feels a little more...
All right. Textured. So, so in that context, do you believe that Keep the Lights On qualifies as independent?
Yes. I think pretty much everything on here does.
Okay.
I think it's just when you have a big studio backing... You know, a film, or you know, when it's the Weinsteins, is everyone like that? You always just feel like there's a little like under the table dealing going on. So you know, obviously, you know, Silver Linings Playbook. I enjoy that film. I enjoy the performances. Actually, the most impressive performance in Silver Linings for me was Robert De Niro's performance as the father with OCD. I thought that was just the most emotionally naked just acting I've seen from De Niro in so long. I mean, yeah. I think I was even saying all the way back to Jackie Brown, you could take it as just his most fascinating performance in a while. So it was wonderful to see him vital again.
Had you seen Being Flynn this year?
I did see Being Flynn. I had mixed feelings about it. Okay. I thought it was good from him, but it was kind of a prelude to this performance.
Interesting, because I felt his performance in Being Flynn was a little stronger than...
Really?
Because, again, I have very mixed emotions about Silver Linings Playbook. Mm. I had unfortunately heard a lot of the hype before I sat down to watch it.
You always try not to listen. You try to blot it out. And especially when it's like the Weinsteins. They have that hype machine cranked so high, you just want to push back at some point.
And I found some very good things in that movie, but I also found that, I mean, I did not like the ending. I didn't like how Jennifer Lawrence was being used in it, but... Boy, there were some intriguing elements. Like the scene with her and Chris Tucker in the dance studio was probably one to me the finest moment in the film. Only because, you know, she played a character who had become promiscuous after her husband's death, and then she was being overtly sexual with Chris Tucker in a way that she could not be with the Bradley Cooper character.
Yes. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I thought that was the most vital moment in the film, and the rest of it. To me, it was just filling, and again, I had problems with the ending. But
yes, and I mean, and I think Bradley Cooper's work is impressive in the sense that it's different from a lot of what we've seen before.
I agree with that. I think it's spotty too, but I would say
I feel like it's spotty. I feel like if it wasn't Bradley Cooper doing it, I feel like his performance wouldn't have as much hype behind it. But I feel like people are just very impressed to see a different, you know, angle on him. And I love Jennifer Lawrence. I've always thought she was one of the best actresses out there. But I just thought that performance, I mean, there's certain mannerisms to the acting that work on kind of a screwball comedy level. But then when you want to take them into the realm of drama, it gets a bit clunky for me. You know,
you're defining my problems with the film.
So I don't know. It. Silver Linings, I can take or leave that.
Right.
Moonrise Kingdom for me is the winner.
Well, let's go to your definition for the first best feature, because you know the other categories sort of relate to everything we've been talking about.
Best first feature, and I've actually I will freely admit I've only seen three of the nominees on here. I have not seen Fill the Void or Gimme the Loot. Gimme the Loot got a lot of positive word of mouth. I think that might have been at the Chicago International this year.
Yes, it was, and that's where I saw it. And
I
interviewed the director, and a tremendously nuanced piece for a subject matter that is kind of underground. And here is this nebbishy guy with glasses making a film about two African-American graffiti hustlers in New York, doing it in a way that is honest and true and perfectly in line with how you'd think a story like that would go.
Mm-hmm.
Very impressive. Very impressive first. And I didn't see Fill the Void at all. But
we can talk about both
other
on my must-see list,
just in
terms of their nomination in this category. Absolutely. Sound of My Voice includes the lovely, radiant Britt Marling. My goodness. And she was the star... Well, she was the star of Another Earth, which I know you were a champion of that film. But Sound of My Voice was the film that introduced me to Britt Marling, and I was like, now I can see the hype. She is a stunning actress, and this film, it's a really wonderful edge of your seat thriller. And I have issues with the ending. It's again one of those things where you're questioning reality, questioning what's happening, and it's always tricky about how to wrap up one of those things. I feel like Martha Marcy May Marlene is still the best example of how to wrap it up. But this one does a brilliant, I mean, all the way to the end, I was on the edge of my seat. And it's all about Britt Marling as this woman who says that she's from the future.
Yes.
And she has this whole cult around her. And you don't find out until, like the second, it's really just a series of vignettes, and every vignette that you see in this film pulls the rug out from under the last vignette and shows something entirely different. So the whole first thing, we're just seeing these people getting ready for their first, you know, meeting with the cult, and they're going to become part of the cult. And the very next scene, you see those people becoming the new cult members are actually documentary filmmakers that want to show what a fraud she is. It's really interesting because then they start getting drawn in, and yeah, it's really
well. Also, I will say about that, I had no problems with the ending because I thought to myself after I saw it, how else can they end it?
Well, see, that's the thing. That's always a problem. I mean, it's always right. These films are always a process of writing yourself into the corner of like, how much ambiguity can you keep? And sometimes the less you say, that's what Martha does for me. It's like the less you say, the more it resonates.
Very good. And a safety not guaranteed.
Yeah.
Again, I have to say, there were parts of it where I wasn't really tracking. And then it just built up a lot of steam and then spectacular ending on that.
Mm-hmm.
Spectacular. And really, it's just about trusting, you know, the people you are with and who you are. Trusting who you are and trusting the relationships that you make because of who you are.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Beautiful.
I will say, I saw this in a theater. I paid to see this. I didn't get to see the critic screening. And I sat next to a woman who was basically giving herself an entire manicure the entire film. So noisy that it started to derail my attention. What I remember about this film, it was pretty awful. But what I remember, I remember liking
the film. You remember that about the film?
Yes, I remember that. I remember liking the film. What I liked most was the chemistry between Aubrey Plaza and Mark Duplass. I just loved like the blooming of their relationship, and every time the film averted its attention to something else, it felt a little less developed, a little less rich.
Well, I'll tell you
that's what I want to see it again, because that was my initial reaction.
I thought the weakest character in that was for one thing, Lennis put a moratorium on people having publishing jobs. All right,
sure,
where they
sure.
actually make a living. Matt, can you relate to that?
No, no, I can't. So,
but anyway, that character of the hip magazine writer guy who wanted to meet his high school girlfriend again was way overwritten.
Yeah, I thought those scenes were very weak in comparison to the other stuff.
I had a little more affection toward him towards the end, but I didn't think the actor pulled off the reunion very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought he was way overwritten. So, yeah, there were some flaws in it, but...
But the central love story, and it should have been a little more central, in my opinion, but that really works. So it's definitely worth checking out. And then The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Yes.
This is definitely the most studio-bred, first feature in this category. But I frankly don't care because I absolutely loved it. And I was not expecting to love it as much as I did. But I thought the fact that they got Stephen Chbosky, who wrote the book that this film is based on, to write and direct the film.
And direct.
Could you think of a better person to do it? I mean,
it's like Picasso bringing one of his paintings to life or something. I mean, that's extreme.
But it's like having the artist who originated these characters and then putting it into cinematic context that does not feel watered down in any way.
Beautiful summary of that, yeah.
It's just bereft of sentiment. Sort of like excessive sentiment.
But I will say one thing about it, and one of the things
that keeps
me from totally embracing it.
Yeah.
Is that it was a highly romanticized version of a circumstance like that.
Sure.
Immediately everybody will go back to their high school days when you watch this film, which is one of its beautiful contributions. But I just felt like the main situation, the narrative of the main situation, was coming to some conclusions that were just a little too twee for me.
Sure.
Okay.
I understand that. And also the fact that there's a lot left off screen that's probably some of the most interesting stuff in the film, and yet is really an entirely different film altogether.
Yeah.
Where it would sort of break tonally entirely. Yeah, I mean, if it's sort of like in the last 10 minutes,
the mental health
wondering.
Aspect of it, you know, is his viability with his mental health. That's a whole nother movie.
Yes.
We're just seeing a segment of that story within the context of him mm-hmm. making friends in high school.
Yes, but I will say for me, what held that whole film, even down to the last 10 minutes together, was Logan Lerman's performance as the main character, as the wallflower, as the kid who's so uncomfortable in his skin. He does this thing with his mouth where he's kind of almost looks like he's like munching gummy bears or something. I mean, it's like you could see he's almost like uncomfortable just sitting down and just being with all of his peers. And my goodness, I mean, who doesn't remember feeling like that in high school?
Exactly.
Or at least everyone thinks they're the only one that feels it. But that Lerman performance just brings all of that back to life. And I just thought he was astounding in it, because I've never cared for him in any other movie I've seen. I feel like he's
always
been...
You don't like Percy and the Olympians,
no,
sir?
No, I never cared for him. But
what
this
is Percy's last name?
Percy Jackson.
I thought it was Percy Faith.
Yeah.
Well, there's a generational
Percy
joke.
Percy Faith. Oh, no, good. Oh, man. That's what we got to have you on here, Pat, because you get to that demographic I just can never quite capture there.
Yes,
so.
Right.
But but yeah, so there you have it. Yeah, Logan Lerman, incredible.
So anything else do you want to cover on this?
I mean, basically, is there anything else nomination-wise that you think are especially surprising or you're very glad to see on there?
Very good. Okay, go ahead.
Matthew McConaughey is a double nominee this year. He is nominated for Best Male Lead for Killer Joe and Best Supporting Male for Magic Mike, which I thought was interesting. I thought this was a pretty wonderful year for McConaughey. Just the fact that it's been so many years, he's just seemed to kind of be like asleep at the wheel. He's kind of coasting on his abs and his sort of like Kate Hudson romantic comedy.
He is, and
it was just so great to see him remember that, oh yeah, I'm an actor again, and really kind of come back to life here in a big way.
All right.
I mean, exactly. Because, I mean, Killer Joe is so close to like unwatchably offensive.
Wow.
That it really straddles that line so dearly, and yet it totally works, and it's a lot because of the actors too. I just think in terms of you have to not care about these people people and just kind of capture the dark comedy aspect of
it. And he was also in the infamous The Paperboy this year.
Yeah.
And I want to tell you, that is one messed up movie, baby.
That's what I've heard.
I almost put Nicole Kidman's performance as a Best Supporting Actress. She was just outside my five.
And she's made the five in the Golden Globes and a few other places. Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah.
You got to see it to believe it, folks. I'm very pleased that Mary Elizabeth Winstead is on the list for Smashed.
Oh, Smashed. Yes, I heard
a
good stuff about that.
A terrific performance. Done by a player who is absolutely willing to do what it takes to interpret such a role. Mm. And I've said this before and I'll say it again, Smashed is a must-see because it's finally showing a generation that you don't expect to have problems with alcohol-related addiction.
Sure. I heard it was like a 20-something Days of Wine and Roses.
Yes, pretty
thing.
Much. Yeah. That's a perfect description.
Yeah.
And you know what's funny about that description, too, if we go back to Days of Wine and Roses, they were probably on the outskirts of 20 and 30.
Sure. Exactly.
But
you just don't think of it like that.
Right. You don't
cast.
Think of it like that because of the cast. But here, if you compare the two movies, they're talking about the same sort of age groups, but see how the world has changed.
Yeah.
See how different a Days and Wine and Roses situation. And a lot of it had to do with the arrested development of that type of generation. There's a terrific scene where the now sober Mary Elizabeth's character comes in, and they're playing video games, and they're drunk. They're drunk. Her husband's friends and her husband are all like wasted, and you could have went 10 years before, and they would have been doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A very, very telling statement on the generation.
No, I'll definitely be seeing that. And the other one in that category, actually, Linda Cardellini. I'm happy to see there for Return as a soldier who comes back home and sees that her life is absolutely different from what it is. Okay, so we have to both see each other's nominee. But yeah, Cardellini's magnificent in that film as well. And her husband's played by Michael Shannon in that too, and he definitely ups everyone's game and everything he does.
I'm glad to see Anne Dowd for Compliance.
Absolutely. Now, she's in Supporting Female, which just kills me because she is an absolute lead in that film.
She's driving everything.
She
makes the conclusion in the film.
Yes.
I have to tell you, Matt, and this is just a quick aside personal thing.
Sure.
My parents have been indulging in these films lately because of my influence, obviously, of what I do.
Sure.
So they, in a week, saw The Master. smashed, and compliance. my 75-year-old parents.
Oh, my gosh.
Went and saw. But compliance was very disturbing to them because they both grew up in a generation where authority will not be questioned.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you ever, you know, try to get like a job at just kind of like a, you know, like a fast food joint or stuff like that, and you have to like, you know, write out those surveys. Oh, my goodness. I mean, all of the, I think I even mentioned this to Nick Allen in another podcast where it's like the Borders survey where you have to write down like, are people by nature good, or, you know, things like that. Or, you know, do you ever question authority? Because they want you to just kind of blindly follow things. And it's it really kind of, you know, just attacks that American mentality of just kind of just kowtow, being subordinate and not having a thought of your own.
And the brilliance, of course, of setting it in the fast food industry, not only not a top tier fast food, but some sort of low level regional, you know, whatever the heck they were making in that place. Horrible. Yes. And you could feel the grease and the.
Yes.
And, I did put Drema.
Yes, our Drema Walker.
Drema Walker.
Yeah.
It sounds like I'm starting in the jungle.
Drema Walker. Okay. I see what you're saying. I guess.
So I put her as a best supporting performer.
Because she is the supporting performer.
Like
in that
Nicole
film.
Kidman, it is a truly naked performance.
Yeah,
it's
painful to watch.
It's very painful.
Her humiliation. And Ann Dowd is one of the five best lead actresses of the year. Get Helen Mirren from Hitchcock out of there.
Yes, definitely. Well, I didn't,
get her,
you know,
out.
I'm disappointed not to see Helen Hunt on the list.
That was strange. No, she is on the list. She is in best supporting female there. I've got to see what your list is.
No, you're right. She's on.
Yeah, she's on the best friend.
Please
female.
Cut this out, man.
That's okay.
My reputation
right.
is.
No, it's okay.
They're gonna.
You never know what you're gonna.
They're gonna
get
put
online.
Me in a mental institution after listening to this one. Jeez.
No, it's all right.
I wasn't okay. I'm glad. There's another one I'm glad of, Matt.
Yes.
Helen Hunt. Again, let's talk about naked performances. We just talk about Drema Walker. We talk about Nicole Kidman, the Paperboy. These are three actresses who are taking elements of their own sexuality and expressing it in ways that are different than eroticism.
Mm-hmm.
They're for Kidman, the Paperboy, it was about being on the edge and sort of off the rails. Of course, for Drema Walker and compliance, it was about being humiliated. And for Helen Hunt in The Sessions, it was about freeing another individual because of a job. Basically.
Yes, because she's the sex surrogate, whatever you want to call it, to John Hawks, who plays a man with polio. And the film really isn't about sex so much as it's about human intimacy and connection,
right,
and how necessary and vital that is to anyone, regardless of, you know, whatever, you know, situation or physical state that they're in.
Well, I always said, too, it is about the balance of our percentage of emotion and physicality. That we are always fighting with those percentages. How much of an attraction is physicality? How much of an attraction is emotion? And then when the relationship matures, how do those balances change?
Now, one film I really want to see that
yes.
is getting a lot of honors at
yes,
the
Matt.
At the Indie Spirit Awards, it's getting the Robert Altman Award for Ensemble Cast, this film Starlet by Sean Baker, which it's having a run. It might be done by the time this podcast is up, but it's at the Music Box.
Yeah.
And I've heard some very interesting things about this film.
Yeah, please go over there and see that.
Relationship between an old lady, a young lady, and some very naturalistic performances is what I've heard in there. And I mean, there's many different nominees I'm happy to see here. The Invisible War by Kirby Dick is just a shattering expose on the epidemic of rape in the military and all the cover-ups there.
You know,
that was a stunning film.
I have that on my table, and the subject matter was such that I couldn't put it in yet. So.
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. And it's mainly just statistics. I mean, what Kirby Dick does so well, and this is up for Best Documentary at the Spirit Awards, is just making so much power just in statistics being placed on the screen. I mean, he's pretty stunning.
Interesting.
Ben Richardson for cinematography for Beast of the Southern Wild. I think he has that in the bag.
Well,
he'll have
that in the bag at the Oscars, too. Too, hopefully.
He will. He definitely will. Michael Haneke's Amour for Best International Film. That would be my vote because I thought that captured brutally. I mean, it's a film I don't even know if I want to sit through again, but it brutally captured what love really means, what a connection really means between two people, right to the very end. It's a time in life that few films ever even want to venture into, but Haneke does it with such honesty and beauty.
Well, he is truly one of the most original filmmakers working in the atmosphere today.
Absolutely. All right. So, well, thank you so much,
Matt,
for doing this, Pat. Always a pleasure.
Brilliant pleasure. And happy holidays, sir.
Yes, same to you, sir. Absolutely. Right. We'll look forward to seeing the winners of this thing next year, and we'll see how the host does. So, who is the host?
You're searching for outlook. Come to this place.
That's right. Exactly. All right. Thank you so much, Pat. And for all of our recent reviews and interviews, check out HollywoodChicago.com and Indie-Outlook.com. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.